You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, Your Legal Rights is designed to help young people and their families prepare for that transition towards adulthood. Your 18-year-old child is going off to college. What every parent should know about how to prepare for that transition. Or you're turning 18. What's really changed? If arrested, is it really a different world? What about those credit card offers or student loans? What can debt really do to your future? With me in the studio tonight, attorneys Paula Spano, who practices criminal law in Redwood City, and Palo Alto attorney Janet Brewer, who is certified as a specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. If you have questions for my guests, a phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 in the studio. Or if you're outside the local dialing area, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. Again, that number where we pick up the freight, 866-798-8255. Occasionally, I may neglect to mention that while we're happy to answer all of your questions, we stop short of giving precise legal advice without all the facts relating to a given case or a given circumstance. But we're here, we're more than happy to pass along the legal principles that can help guide you in your decision-making. And as always, you can call regarding any question on the topic. And tonight, we're talking about coming of age, transitioning. And we're happy to take any call you may have in that area. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. And again, toll free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And with that, Janet, Paula, let me welcome each of you to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff. Glad to be here.
You know, before we go any further, I'd really like to start with this. We talked about what parents should know. We're going to take, you know, my 18-year-old kid and send him off to college. And, you know, he's looking forward to this independence, but are there things that we should do before he goes?
Well, let me respond to that, Jeff. From my perspective in the estate planning world, it's amazing to me how few parents understand that once their child reaches 18, they no longer have the right to make legal decisions for them, specifically in the areas of health care and if in banking, they have no right to school records, and they need to take steps to get documents in place that would allow them to make those kinds of decisions. The 18-year-old actually needs his own health care directive so that if he were involved in a serious accident and couldn't make his own medical decisions, his parents would have the right to make those decisions, and the doctors would have the rights to talk to the parents about that. They also don't have the right, unless they sign documents, that would allow the parents to find out information about the school grades and other important information that they would think that they have a right to know.
You know, the State Bar publishes publications that are very helpful in this regard. Anybody who's had a child in the system may not know it, but they have access to it. The one I'm looking at is called Kids in the Law, an A to Z guide for parents. And it talks about all sorts of things. It talks about parents' rights, smoking, graffiti, working, school rules, driving, juvenile court, and even the age of majority. So at times, we may refer you back to these things. But, you know, I mentioned in passing juvenile court. Let's talk about adult court. I just turned 18, and I got into a bit of trouble. Is it pretty much the same thing, just a different place, or has the world really changed?
Different world. Very different world. I've practiced juvenile law in delinquency, which is the crimes of the youth. I've also practiced adult criminal law, so I can see the comparison between the two. And in the juvenile system, unless it's a serious crime, there's exceptions and direct filing when I used to practice in this area. But for the most part, the parents had to be consulted by the lawyer. There wasn't really as much privacy when somebody was a minor. There was a focus on rehabilitation efforts, such as different schools and different outreach that they tried to do as interventions. There was a lot of attention paid to what was going to teach and redirect the behavior in a way that wasn't incarceration and punitive. I mean, there was an element of incarceration, but the focus was largely collaborative to try to find the solution to these things. And then there was also aspects of the law where even if you had, we didn't call them a conviction, it's called an adjudication when you're a juvenile. Even if you had these criminal law experiences where the court held that you were guilty, there was a process by which you could seal your record and keep it secret in the future. And employers and people wouldn't have the same access to things that happen when you were a juvenile in most instances than they do when you're an adult.
When fair, fair to say, in juvenile court, for the most part, and we're talking delinquency court because the dependency court, for the most part, there's no parallel for it once you're an adult. But in juvenile court, it's tough love. It's there to help you get back on track to make you a productive adult. And it's really, figuratively speaking, it's people who love you. And when you get to adult court, happily, it's moving more in that direction in certain arenas. There's more collaborative courts. There's more alternative things. And we've had earlier shows on that. But for the most part, if you're in criminal court, what did you do? And what are we going to do to hit you upside the head and get you, not so much to get you back on track, but to send a signal to everybody else, this is what we do to somebody who does this stuff.
And legally, the interesting thing is, when you're 18 years old, you could be guilty of the same crimes that you could commit when you're 50. In fact, you could be guilty of more crimes because there are certain things that are against the law under the age of 21. So you actually have more exposure to potential crimes than at any other age bracket from the ages of 18 till you hit 21. And yet, there's nothing in the law that says, oh, you're under 21 and therefore you get a light sentence. It's not written that way. So that's a hard reality for a lot of people who may have had some brushes with the juvenile system, had a false sense of security, or thought that this focus was going to remain on trying to tenderly address and redirect the problem. And then they get in the adult system, and sometimes they're charged with very serious crimes, and they're surprised.
And as Jackie Gleason would say, and away we go. And away they go. You mentioned sometimes, and again, we're focusing on crimes, there are sometimes crimes or consequences that are uniquely harsh between the ages of 18 and 21. One of those would be marijuana. If you were to possess marijuana over 21, with limited exceptions, it's legal now in California, but certainly not under 21. And sometimes people make the mistake of leaving the state, and it's not always friendly in other places.
Well, it's even worse than that. If you are caught with marijuana under the age of 21, it is a crime, as in most instances it's not if you're over 21. But additionally, if you are not a U.S. citizen and you're here, you know, as an immigrant, and it really depends on the status, and there are people that practice federal immigration law that can analyze the particular situation, but drug offenses have a profound effect on somebody's immigration status. So you could be, if you were 21 years old, it would be no crime. If you're under 21, you would have to worry about the consequences of the charge and the consequences of immigration. And that's just a large problem for somebody that just turns 18. That's an enormous and overwhelming situation for the people that unfortunately find themselves in that position.
One of the things I tell young people when I talk with young people about this, before they've talked to an attorney, before they've got arrested, is never assume anything. Always talk to somebody in the area. Always get that advice, because there's usually relief valves, and it could be a tragic mistake to move without knowing where they are. We're also talking about parents and things that they need to know. Now, as a specialist certified in estate planning, trust, and probate law, a big part of what you do is about preserving wealth, preserving assets, and the like. What kinds of things would you advise parents when, you know, when little Bobby is off to, you know, going off to school? What do you do?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at there, but I mean, certainly you want to make sure that little Bobby is acting responsibly from a financial standpoint. You perhaps, I know a lot of parents give their children credit cards when they go off to school so that they have easy access to a way to pay for things that they need for school. Unfortunately, sometimes the children misuse those credit cards. They don't really understand the consequences of charging things and the idea that they actually have to pay it off, or it's going to affect either their credit rating or their parents' credit rating if their parents have co-signed on those cards. Parents need to be very, very concerned about their own credit rating and take steps to make sure that little Johnny doesn't ruin their credit. Maybe give him a debit card instead of a credit card so that there's some real control, or maybe give him a prepaid credit card rather than just basically going to the bank and getting him a Visa and co-signing for it.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're talking about coming into adulthood, planning, protection. Really, what do we want to do? Both for the young person and for the families that are looking after them. Here in the studio with me tonight, we have attorneys Paula Spano and Janet Brewer. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 in the studio. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on the topic. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation. And again, that number is 866-798-8255. One of the things that you talked about earlier, Janet, was about health care. What kinds of things can the parents do in that regard?
Well, so with healthcare, one of the things that I have my clients do is sign what's called a HIPAA authorization. It's a Health Information Privacy and Protection Act is what the acronym stands for. And many people don't know, doctors are prohibited from divulging private health care information to anyone else, including one's spouse, by the way, which many people don't realize, unless there is an authorization in place that permits them to do it. If they divulge health care information to someone that doesn't have explicit permission to receive that information, they can be fined $10,000 per occurrence. So you know, frankly, I've seen it happen with people at school. The child is riding his bike to class and doesn't have a helmet on and falls down and gets seriously injured, ends up in the hospital. The doctors really don't have permission even to call the parents and let them know that the child's in the hospital if the child can't communicate that information himself. So making sure that parents have taken steps to put themselves into a position where they are entitled to this health information is critical.
It sounds like this is one of those areas where perhaps the lawmakers had the best of intentions, but people have taken it to such extreme measures of enforcement that it's gone completely beyond any reason.
Well, perhaps, but again, we have to remember, even though people think of an 18-year-old as their 18-year-old kid, he's really, or she's really, an 18-year-old adult. And an adult has the right to privacy of his medical data. So, yes, you could say that the lawmakers have taken it to an extreme. But on the other hand, I certainly don't want just anyone being able to have access to my healthcare data. And an 18-year-old has that same right.
What about an under 18?
Under 18, the parents do still have parental rights to make healthcare decisions for the child, unless in the rare case that the child's been emancipated.
So in the case of somebody under 18, presumably the hospital can call home and say this is what's going on because the parents have the right to make decisions, and it wouldn't make sense to have reserve that right and not have the information on which to base those decisions.
Right. And just like Paula was saying, where things flip between juvenile court and adult court, that's true, I think, in the healthcare arena as well. The doctors actually could get into trouble if they were to perform medical procedures on an under 18-year-old unless they had the permission of a responsible adult, whether that's a parent or a legal guardian, but someone with the legal authority to make decisions for that child.
And then beyond that, there's a whole host of things that people should consider. Whose car is it they're driving? What kind of insurance they should carry? Things of that nature.
Right.
The actions of a young adult might really come back and bite the family if it's the family's car. If you put the car in the child's name, child becomes a young adult and they have it, it might be a shield. It won't necessarily, but it might be a shield to liability coming back.
Yeah, at least it would protect the parents from having to shoulder that responsibility. Again, once the 18-year-old turns 18, if it's his or her car, the parents are not legally responsible for that. If the car is in the parent's name, on the other hand, as you say, then they could be held liable for having allowed someone who shouldn't be driving the car to have driven it and perhaps caused physical damage either to someone else's property or injured a person.
And if I can weigh in here for a minute, I used to be an insurance agent before I was a lawyer, so I am familiar with the intersection of those things. And there are a number of interesting issues when you're talking about young drivers. The first issue in terms of insurance is that the insurance companies in California, at least the last time I reviewed the law, are allowed to charge you more if you have been licensed a very short time. And what happens is the insurance companies used to have a practice where they would either raise the policy rates through the roof if there was somebody that's had their license for a year or two, or force that family to drive to fill out a form called a name driver exclusion, saying that their child was not going to drive the car, and then they could keep the lowest rates in the preferred company. And so that's kind of a financial decision. There's a financial impact on families to allow their kids to drive the car. You're not legally responsible You're right, unless you have some kind of financial stake in your child driving the car. But secondly, another thing that's really important about young drivers is that the DUI laws are different for the young drivers versus the 21-year-olds. And it's illegal to drink when you're under 21. And so the amount of blood alcohol that the law allows you to have is lower. The suspension of your driver's license is longer. The remedy for you getting your driver's license back is pretty much non-existent.
Although, for adults this year, you can opt for, on a first offense, having an ignition interlock device that you blow into that won't let you drive if it measures alcohol. You can have one of those installed in your car instead of with a suspension. And with second and thirds, you have, you know, with a DUI with a prior or two priors, you don't even have the choice. You have to put one of those in instead of having a suspension.
And, Jeff, what would happen if someone who had one of those devices drove someone else's car that didn't have that device?
Well, you would be in violation of a restriction. You're driving on a suspended license. The restriction that allows you to drive only allows you to drive with that device, and you are required to put it on to have that installed in any car you own or operate. So if it's someone else's car, you should not be operating it. The liability could, I would think, be significant in the sense that if something went wrong, I would think, and this is new law, so it hasn't been tested, but I would expect to find that that's a pretty damaging thing to come out, and that your liability may be quite a bit, both maybe higher because of the indifference you're showing, but more importantly, maybe well decided against you because you're not using one of those when you should be. As a person under 21, it's not an option to have that device instead of a suspension, but in the alternative, there are different types of hardships that you could apply to the Department of Motor Vehicles to get a restricted license as an alternative. And there's four different ones. They include things like a family member that has a medical situation and you're the one who takes them for care, or you're preserving your job, or you're preserving your education and continuing with that, and there's nobody else in the house that can drive, and they will ask about other people in the drive, other people in the household. But Paul, I didn't mean to cut you off. You were saying how the suspension periods are quite a bit longer, and the relief valves are quite a bit more limited.
Right. I used to be involved in a DUI outreach campaign in my former county of practice that was in conjunction with the law enforcement chaplaincy, the CHP, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, the district attorney's office, the judges, and other community and educational leaders. And we would talk to kids about the dangers of drunk driving and how they shouldn't even consider doing that. And our goal was to make a difference and try to change people's perceptions of drinking and driving. One of the interesting things about it is that if you look at the vehicle code, there is a difference that the DMV will treat you in terms of the suspension if you're under 21. There's also the lower tolerance. You're not able to be a 0.08 or above. It's not that way. And then, you know, from a former insurance agent's perspective, young drivers get into accidents just by virtue of inexperience, by virtue of maybe proclivity to take risks and unfamiliarity with the roads and how to drive. So they're already elevated in terms of the loss experience that insurance companies rate them, the same as people that have been driving for many years and have had a DUI. They rate, oftentimes the rates are pretty similar for somebody who just got their license and is a young driver. So The takeaway from all that is that under no circumstances should people under 21 chance drinking and driving. It's very dangerous. It's going to do irreparable harm. It may result in a lot of consequences that people don't think about, like their car being towed and them being unable to afford to get it back, or them not having a driver's license, or them not going to be able to afford insurance or the interlock device if they ever get their license back. And fines and fees can be thousands of dollars, and that doesn't go away. So these are huge consequences that people, when they're emerging into adulthood and naturally wanting to kind of explore and take chances and be less risk adverse than we are as adults, they're like, this is a really kind of vulnerable population to get into this kind of trouble. And so I think it's really important to have conversations with your youngsters about these issues so you can avoid these huge problems, because it just takes a moment of misjudgment to really alter your future.
One of the things people don't think of is the connection of activities that have nothing to do with driving a car that could cost a young person their driver's license. And you mentioned, well, we were talking about alcohol in general or drug use, but those don't have to be connected to driving to take away a driver's license. And one of the things I tell people is, if you're going to sin, don't do it out in public, because it could cost you your driver's license for things that have nothing to do with driving. A young person that is under the influence of alcohol in a public place, the police see you, they determine you've done something that's connected with drugs or alcohol, and your driver's license is suspended for a year. It has nothing to do with driving at the time. It does afterwards, but you haven't been driving a car. And now you have to justify how I can drive to work if you need to drive to work, or how I can drive to school if you need to go to school, or how I can get my father to the doctor because he needs dialysis and there's no one else that can drive. And you've got to make that attempt. You've got to lodge that battle just because you had a couple of drinks and went out in public instead of doing your sinning in private. So remember, you're vulnerable, not only criminally, but in other ways that may seem a little different. We're going to change direction. I want to talk about a couple of other things. In a moment, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, when we were talking just before going on the air, Jen and I were talking, you suggested something about a directive about a child's ability to make health care decisions. And what if they're incapacitated, and who can do those for you now that the doctors can't even tell your parents that you're there? So I want to shift gears and talk a little bit about that when we come back, which will be in just a moment. Again, we're talking about coming of age and what parents should know, what young people should know. Tonight, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. If you have questions for my guests, and tonight we're talking with Janet Brewer, certified estate planning attorney out of Palo Alto, and Paula Spano, practicing criminal law in Redwood City. Questions for my guests, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the dialing area, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on the topic. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
And as I mentioned, when we were talking before going on the air, Janet, you mentioned about a good idea for little Johnny to complete an advance directive. And for those who don't know, that's a document that specifies your wishes and for medical treatment in the event that you're not able to make decisions. I guess the one thing I would ask you is, how do we convince little Johnny that this is necessary? I mean, in some ways, they're like living wills, and the widespread assumption is that living wills are for older people that are nearing death, and little Johnny doesn't see himself as fallible or that something like that would happen soon. Why should he bother?
That's a really good question, Jeff. And frankly, as I mentioned to you before we went on the air, I actually just had an 18-year-old in my office today who's going to be leaving for UC Irvine next week. And she signed both an advanced healthcare directive, a HIPAA authorization, and a power of attorney for finances. And frankly, what generally happens, these kids don't come wandering into my office by themselves. Their parents bring them in. They have listened to a program like this, or they've read online about a horror story that someone has endured where their child was in a coma in a hospital and they were not able to make decisions for them. And they bring the kid in and basically say, if you want me to be paying for your college tuition, you're going to sign these documents. So it really generally is not something that a child or an 18-year-old does voluntarily. Usually it's at the strong direction of one of their parents that causes them to do it.
You know, we talked a little bit about criminal, a little bit about driving, a little bit about controlled substances or alcohol, and a little bit about healthcare and whether it's privacy or directives. One of the things we didn't talk about are things that are completely unconnected with either driving or controlled substances. And after Prop 21 passed, anybody 21 or under can lose their license for other things. Can anybody explain a rationale why somebody convicted of tagging or really any kind of vandalism might lose their license?
There was actually what I've heard about this, this is word on the street, so to speak. That actually started a long time ago, and there was a huge tagging problem back in the 70s. And they were kind of scratching their heads going, how do we get all of this tagging to stop? And somebody came up with the idea that kids love their driver's licenses. And if that's a consequence and they experience that consequence, it may stop the behavior. So that's what I heard the original idea came from. But that's, again, word on the street.
One of the things that we talk about with young people is how to deal with the fact that you're dealing with a police officer. What if you get pulled over? What if they come to you and want to talk to you? Any advice there?
Well, it's interesting that if you're an adult, you don't have a right to an attorney until they actually file charges against you. I mean, people say, oh, they didn't read me my rights. And the police don't have to read you your rights, only when they are conducting a custodial interrogation do they have to read you your rights. So there's a period of time where people are literally unprotected.
Now, if you have an attorney,
then you have protection. So if you... What I tell my clients that may be dealing with immigration issues because they're scared and that's kind of a dicey situation where they're unfamiliar and here's somebody with a badge and power and they don't. I tell them never lie, but tell them that you'd love to talk to them, but their lawyer told them not to speak to you. I think I said that wrong. Say that my lawyer insists that I don't speak with you and carry the lawyer's card around with you, so that's a way that's kind of a buffer between the law enforcement questioning and you kind of being put on the spot. That would be good advice, I think, for somebody that is young. I know, Jeff, you're familiar with juvenile practice and have practiced it recently, and it's a very quickly evolving field. So you would know what the differences are in terms of interrogation. There are different rules for when you're a minor versus when you're an adult on police interrogations.
They're not that different when you're 16 or older. Anybody under the age of 18 has the right to not only ask for an attorney, but whereas the police don't have to advise them, somebody under 18 can say, I want my parent or responsible adult that's raising them, and the police have to make that person available or stop questioning them. Now, that law is evolving a little bit, but what's newer is that a child 15 or younger, so anybody under 16, can no longer waive their right to have an attorney. They can't waive their Miranda rights. The police can't simply say you have the right to remain silent, but you want to talk to me anyway, right? And just before they answer, just go right into questions like they would with an adult. And they don't ask if you want to talk to them. They tell you this is the right, do you understand? Boom, they're hitting you with questions. They're not letting you process that information. You can't do that with somebody under 16. As of the first of last year, the law has evolved to where now, if you're under 16, there has to be a chance for the child to consult with an attorney before they can waive their right to remain silent. And any attorney worth his or her salt is going to tell the child the first thing you want to do is to say absolutely nothing. And they'll cut off the questioning. So most agencies are not even going down that road. Most of them now are simply taking it for granted. If you've got somebody under 16, run with what you got. Book them if you're going to, but don't even question them, at least not while they're in custody. Out of custody may be different.
Jeff, so obviously I don't practice criminal law, but I have a friend who does, and he has a phrase that I think is marvelous. He says, remember, a fish only gets caught if it has its mouth open. So keep your mouth shut.
Well, I like that. I like that. I'll use that.
I explain to my clients in terms of talking to law enforcement, it's really interesting. The rules of evidence pursuant to the evidence code actually change. If you say something that helps you, it's hearsay. If you say something that hurts you, it's an admission or a confession. So, you know, the helpful stuff only comes in if it's needed to understand the larger conversation. But literally, when they say anything you say can and will be used against you, there's a legal basis for them saying will instead of maybe, could be. It's not that language. It's will be used against you.
To really understand that concept and have it make sense, understand that hearsay is a statement that's made out of court. You can't just bring it in and repeat it. And there's an exception for what's called an admission. And an admission is made by a party opponent. So if the state is prosecuting you, you've said something that's an admission, the state can use it against you. You can't use it under most circumstances. There's exceptions, but under most circumstances, you cannot use it. And similarly, since the state tends not to speak, you can't necessarily use what a police officer or really anybody else says against you because they're not a party. They're a witness. So it gets very complicated. Your attorney can give you more precise advice on how that works. Same thing as in civil. If you're trying to bring in a statement that's outside of court, you really have a lot better ability to do it when it's the party you're engaged in a lawsuit with than when it's somebody else who might only be a witness. We talked about pot smoking. You can't legally possess it if you're under 21. What about smoking cigarettes? It used to be where it was unlawful for a juvenile to have a cigarette, but isn't that under 18 rather than 21, or can you not have a cigarette until you're 21? if you know.
You're the practitioner in current juvenile practice, Mr. Hayden, so I'll bounce that question back to you.
Well, that question is evolving today. And as far as a cigarette goes, it's an under 18 issue. But as far as vaping goes, that's changing very, very rapidly. And just today, the Trump administration said that they are going to change the regulations so that flavored vaping, those products are going off the market. They just announced it today because they're clearly aimed at young people. And we've had very recently a number of deaths and a whole lot more people that are hospitalized for vaping. So I think that law is going to evolve very, very rapidly. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, with me in the studio, attorneys Janet Brewer and Paula Spano are speaking with me about coming into adulthood, what parents, what young people need to know. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on the topic. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation. Again, if you're outside of the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. So we've talked a little bit about a health care and maybe a directive. We've talked a bit about credit cards, student loans. What other planning do you think parents might do for their young person or the young person might do to really get a sense of what they're doing? I mean, they're entering into a huge adventure. They're going to be really making decisions on their own. What other planning can they do ahead of time?
Well, to a certain extent, Jeff, that depends on what the parents' resources are. If they don't have a lot of extra resources around, they probably aren't going to engage in that many planning activities. And frankly, the child probably isn't going to be exposed to that much money that they have serious concerns. But serious financial concerns. One of the things that you touched on before that we were touching on is, and this goes more to the parents' financial situation than the children's, what if a child is involved in a serious accident and it causes either extensive property damage or extensive injuries that exceed the insurance? Certainly if the child is under 18, regardless of, you know, and I'm assuming that it's a car accident, but if a child is under 18, the parent is probably going to be held vicariously liable for whatever the damages are. If the child is over 18 but the parent's name is on the car, they may very well be facing some financial repercussions of their own. Paula may have some thoughts about this, but one of the things that I often suggest to my clients, in fact, I almost always suggest to my clients, is that they obtain an umbrella insurance policy. So that the way that an umbrella policy works, if you've got car insurance that covers, you know, $50,000 worth of damage, and that's the upper level of the policy limit. The umbrella policy basically starts with a $50,000 deductible and then goes up to $1 million or $2 million or whatever the maximum is under your umbrella. It's extremely inexpensive insurance. It's usually a couple of $100s for the first $1 million of coverage and maybe $100 to $150. For every million in excess of that. And it is certainly a way to protect the parents' finances against any damage that they might be responsible, both things that they themselves do as well as things that their children do.
Well, the best piece of advice I have is when people first get their driver's license, and maybe most people, I don't know how many people know this and how many people have looked into insurance, but when you say, I have insurance, the law says that it's legal for you to drive if you have $15,000 per person for injury, $30,000 per accident, and $5,000 in property damage. So you got to try to hit a car that's less than $5,000. Because anything over that, they can come after you. And anyone else who's legally responsible. And so there's a big difference between the $15,000 minimum. When people call the insurance company, I want insurance. I don't know how many companies would quote the minimum. I don't know how many companies would quote above the minimum. I don't know how many people would think to ask what the difference is. But the price difference isn't that much. And the umbrella policy will fit over a certain amount. It varies from company to company, but usually you have to max out the first insurance to be somewhere in the area of $300,000 per person, $300,000 per accident, and $100,000 property damage, and then the umbrella fits on top of that. But there's a wide range of insurances that you can get, and not a lot of price difference between having $300,000 worth of coverage and $15,000 worth of coverage.
And I think to that point, I think that the parents need to take a look at what is the relative risk of having the cheap policy where they've saved a couple of $100 on the insurance, but they're exposed now to, you know, they've just hit a brand new, their child has just hit a brand new Mercedes and has done some serious damage to it. And how are they going to come up with the $50,000 or $60,000 of cost that may be attributed to that? Where's that money going to come from? Although they may think that the insurance is expensive, certainly the cost of having to repair that, not to mention if there's any kind of physical damage that's not covered by the injured party's insurance, it's going to be a lot more expensive than that.
Now, if I had to give advice to youngsters on what they should plan and prepare for, my answer would be slightly different. And that is something that I think is just kind of interesting. Money is something that people aren't supposed to talk about. And so nobody really does. And so, I mean, I disagree. Sometimes when you don't have money, you value the money that you do get and learn how to plan and strategize smartly with the money that you come across. And sometimes when you have a lot of excess and there's no need, then there's no focus on that area. But I think everybody, regardless of their financial situation and the financial situation of their parents, can learn how to handle money smartly. And that is something that there's all kinds of free online resources. If they want to just do a little bit of reading, they can find out how to, you know, get good credit. They can find out how to have the right insurance. They can find out how to set a budget and make financial decisions that are really smart, that they can find ways to ignore the credit card offers. When I went to college, they would give out a T-shirt if you apply for a credit card. And when I was 18, I fell for it. And I'm sure that a lot of 18-year-olds still fall for it. And I'm sure that it's probably better than a T-shirt now. But there are things that youngsters can learn and families can learn, and everybody would benefit. And I would really put more of a focus on kind of financial knowledge and planning than exists in today's society. That's the advice that I would give.
I would agree with that 100%. There are some excellent programs that people can take where they can learn about various aspects of credit. They can, whether it's an 18-year-old or an adult, there's a lot of good programs that are being put on in the community colleges about what you need to know about finance. Should you buy a car? Should you lease a car? What are the relative costs of the buy decision versus the lease decision? How do you make those kinds of choices? What do you need to know when you rent an apartment? What kinds of financial problems might you be on the hook for? Should you get homeowners? Well, I guess if it's an apartment, it would be renter's insurance. Should you get content insurance for your property? And as you said, one of the biggest problems is parents don't talk to their children about this. Frankly, parents don't talk to their adult children about this. I have 80-year-olds that don't want their children who are in their 50s and 60s to have any knowledge of what their financial situation is. And if something happens, when something happens to that 80-year-old, the children have no idea of where to start. They don't know where the financial records are located. They can't make heads or tails of them. More and more financial records are being kept digitally, and the children don't know, don't have access to the passwords, so they can't find the financial documents. Again, you get into privacy laws with the banks. They don't have, the parents themselves don't have powers of attorney in place, so the banks can't talk to them. The parents are now incompetent, and they end up having to hire someone to do a conservatorship proceeding, which is the California word for an adult guardian proceeding when someone is incapable of making their own financial decisions.
But even if you don't go down the path, the most extreme path, there's always the question of, you know, before the age of 18, there was, you know, you don't have the same right to enter into contracts as you do when you turn 18. And then when you have that right to enter into contracts, how do you build credit? And so there's some really smart things that parents can do that don't expose themselves to a lot of risk, that aren't going to cost a lot of money, that can assist their youngsters to build their credit, and so that can increase the credit score, such as, you know, putting utilities in the now 18-year-old's name and establishing a track record of payment history. Now, I'm not a financial planner, but there's a lot of things that you can do to really give a good jump start credit-wise. Once you have talked to your youngster about avoiding these kind of credit card traps, to put them in good footing, and that would really, really make a difference moving forward.
One of the other things I find that fascinates me is we've been talking somewhat about defensive things to put a person in a better posture, avoid liability, but I was recently researching the idea of the fact that a child can't pursue a lawsuit. Their parents decide either to do it or not do it. So you could have a civil suit that perhaps has been lingering for a long time because the child's parents chose not to pursue it. And here they are 5 years, 10 years later, and to learn that the limitations period, which would have run out years earlier for an adult, has been told the whole time. So if little Johnny was struck by a car when the neighbors are backing out of their driveway and still have some residual problems, little Johnny can decide at 18 or 19, you know, my parents should have pursued that and gotten my medical problems taken care of, and I'm going to do it now. Because the whole time they were under 18 and had not the ability to make that decision, the clock's not been running.
Yeah, I don't have experience in that. I assume, but I don't know, that if that were the case, I don't know how long the statute of limitation, I don't know if they would have the remainder of time under the statute of limitations, or if it would just extend it for perhaps a year. That would be something that would be important to research if there were a child that was in that kind of a situation. And it may very well be true that that would also apply if the child was under a disability that extended beyond age 18 as well. I don't know the answer to those questions.
I think from my limited research, and this, and I am a criminal defense attorney, so I don't look into these areas so much. But from my limited understanding, I think that you would have the longer of either the remaining period of under the statute or a 2-year statute that starts when you're 18. We really are out of time, and I wanted to afford each of you a minute to 2 minutes each. If there's any closing comments you have, anything you want to say. Janet, would you like to throw anything out there at our listeners?
Again, I think that it's important. Paula brought this up. It at the very least, 18-year-olds are adults. They do need to start taking financial responsibility. The schools, unfortunately, don't seem to do a really good job of providing financial literacy programs for teenagers when they're in high school. But once the kids get into college, there are elective courses that they could take in various financial areas, and I think it would stand them well, whatever they're going to do in life, if they were to take one of those courses so that they start to learn for themselves what they should do. Again, also learning what they can about the law. There are courses in the community colleges that are very inexpensive where they can learn about their legal rights, and I think that it would be smart of them to do that as well.
And my overall thought, from a 10,000-foot view, having raised a teenager myself and now seeing him as a wonderful adult, you know, just when you turn 18, legal magic happens. But there's still brain development. There's still development of judgment. There's still the feeling that nothing can touch you. So there's kind of a disconnect between the amount of responsibility that you're given and your ability to handle it. And it's an adjustment period. But it's also interesting that the criminal laws and the financial laws don't give any slack just because you're 18. So it's a very interesting time, and it's a time where the more family and other kind of resources and support that these youngsters can have, the better.
And there's always the lawyer referral service. You can always call the local county bar association, get referred to a lawyer for a low-cost referral. So if you want to know about how to complete a durable power of attorney, certainly your estate planning attorney can help you. But if you don't have one, if you're not in that position, call the lawyer referral service. San Francisco County Bar, the San Mateo County Bar, the Alameda County Bar, they all maintain these things. They're there for your help. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we've been talking about helping young people and their families prepare for that transition towards adulthood. With me in the studio tonight, my guests have been attorneys Paula Spano, who practices criminal law in Redwood City, California, and Palo Alto attorney Janet Brewer, who is certified as a specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law by the California Board of Legal Specialization. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Next week, we'll discuss employment rights after a work injury with workers' compensation specialist Robert Wyman and employment attorney Tracy Hinden. And 2 weeks from now, we'll be back with Call a Lawyer Night. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco or KALW.org. For production assistant Martin McLean and at the controls, Joanne Marr, I'm Jeff Hayden. Our thanks to you for listening, and have a good night.